Hi, I'm Daisy.
Hi, I'm David.
And we're the MSA Crusaders.
Welcome to another episode of MSA Crusaders. Today we have a very special guest.
He is a professor and chair of neurology and directs the Neurodegenerative Disorders Division at University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. His clinical practice and research focuses on Parkinson's disease, dystonia, Huntington's disease, tremor, and other neurodegenerative disorders. As the director of Parkinson's Foundation Comprehensive Care Center and the Cure PSP Center of Care UAMS, he also provides oversight and direction for UAMS outreach, education, and support programs for over 6,000 people living with Parkinsonism in Arkansas.
He diagnosed me 2.5 years ago after 2 years of being misdiagnosed. Thank you so much for taking time to join us today out of your busy schedule. Welcome to the show, MSA Crusaders, Dr. Dahl.
Thank you, Daisy and David. I appreciate the opportunity of being at the show and talking more about multiple systems atrophy.
Can you tell the listeners what the key symptoms of MSA are that distinguish it from Parkinsonism?
I think this comes up a lot. Multiple systems atrophy can look a lot like Parkinson's, especially to at the beginning and to people who don't know or understand the nuances of the two disorders, especially one of the common subtypes, MSA-P, or the Parkinsonian variant of MSA. MSA-C, the cerebellar variant, is easier to separate out from Parkinson's disease because of early coordination difficulties and cerebellar signs that people exhibit in that disorder. But generally, when we see people for the first time in the clinic with a concern for Parkinson's, especially in the right age group, and toward that, I'll share that multiple systems atrophy, the Parkinsonism variety, tends to happen earlier at a younger age. And Daisy, I think you're very familiar with that. It starts earlier. And when we first meet people in that right age group, we keenly elicit signs and symptoms that it be called red flag signs, Parkinson's disease. We look for any evidence of autonomic impairment. So the automatic processes of the body, like regulating blood pressure, heart rate control, sweat function, bladder control, bowel control, all of these are not expected to be impaired to the same degree in early mild Parkinson's as when it's multiple systems atrophy of the Parkinsonian variety. In addition to looking for these symptoms of autonomic dysfunction, we look for clues like any significant leaning of the trunk to one side or the other, tipping of the head forward, or tipping of the head to the side. So those are important clues early in the disease that something other than Parkinson's might be going on. In the first couple of years, we look for response to medicines and see, is the response what is expected for Parkinson's disease? Often multiple systems atrophy, the Parkinsonian variety, the response is proportionately smaller than what we see in Parkinson's disease. The distribution of side effects is different in MSAP. People tend to be more sensitive, for instance, to drops of blood pressure from the medicines that we tend to use. And although this is not as commonly sought, the distribution of some of the side effects, like the presence of dyskinesias in MSAP, may be very different than dyskinesias in Parkinson's. The presence of dystonia as a consequence of treating, again, may be very different than in Parkinson's. And so when we're looking at overall profile of an individual in the first clinic visit, when the concern is Parkinson's disease, at most movement disorder practices, these are important red flags that we look for. Often, if we identify red flags, we're much more likely to ask for additional investigations to understand, is there imaging that is consistent with multiple systems atrophy picture that, rather than Parkinson's? Although with imaging, with MRI scans, the sensitivity is low. We're only able to pick up about 60% or so of people on imaging, on brain scans, where brain scans are more consistent with Parkinson's than with multiple systems atrophy than with Parkinson's. In spite of all of this, in spite of the better understanding of the differences between Parkinson's and MSA, this is stuff that we teach our residents, our trainees. When I had fellows, this is stuff that we teach our fellows. I want to share with the group that misdiagnosis is, it remains common. Misdiagnosis is still common.
Yeah.
And the last kind of systematic study that I remember looking at MSA, at people who were diagnosed with MSA on autopsy, what their diagnosis at the time of death was, about half of them were still diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at the time that they passed away. This is after they've been under care of some really, really good neurologists for all of their time with Parkinsonism.
Right. And I know it only took about 5 minutes and you diagnosed me, so you can tell the red flags of what it is, Parkinson's or MSA, quickly.
I think, Daisy, I think for you in particular, there was also this this availability of information from the time of diagnosis till you came in to see me and how things had evolved. I think I would want to share that this is difficult. You know, if I saw somebody for the first time in the clinic with mild Parkinsonism, I tell them, it looks like Parkinson's disease. We're going to be watching you very closely over the next 2 years, because a lot of times that, initial kind of red flags for what the diagnosis is emerge over that time frame. And our clinical certainty of the diagnosis tends to improve with time, whether we diagnose somebody with possible multiple systems atrophy or clinically possible Parkinson's disease. That certainty tends to get better. So I think it was a combination of the systems that we have in place to be methodical about assessing our patients, and also some degree of hindsight available by the time I saw you.
Right. And how long have you known about MSA?
You know, like most medical students, I learned first about multiple systems atrophy when I was in medical school. This is giving away my age. This is 27 years ago. And at that time, MSA was known by other names. So we used in medical textbooks, even at that time, the most current textbooks that we had, which is Textbook of Medicine, edited in 1993 by Harrison and others. MSA was not the common term used. We used terms like Scheidreger syndrome for people who have severe autonomic problems in the setting of Parkinsonism. We used striatonigral degeneration, which is a pathological term. And for MSAC, we use the term olivopontocerebellar atrophy, OPCA, especially sporadic OPCA is what we now know as MSAC. So there were other names for the disorder. And again, I read about them in medical textbooks. But once I started my training in neurology in 2004 onward, because of my specific interest in Parkinson's and related degenerative brain disorders, I learned about, and also at that time, landscape was changing. You know, we understood that alpha-synuclein is a common theme to multiple synucleinopathies, including multiple systems atrophy, no matter what the presentation, whether it's MSA or the Parkinson's variety or the cerebellar variety. And then towards the end of my training, in my fellowship and onward, I've been involved in research to understand and treat MSA better.
What advances have been made in research or treatments for patients with MSA?
I will share what would be, I guess, less obvious to the group. So some of the main advancements that have happened actually are what our patients would consider would be obvious needs or common sense needs in calling the condition what it is, in understanding the biology of multiple systems atrophy, and coming up with uniform ways of measuring the disease. So some of the critical advancements actually have been ensuring that when we say multiple systems atrophy, that there's a definition that's universally understood by clinicians and research about what we're talking about. The criteria for diagnosing somebody with multiple systems atrophy, for example, that's really, really important for us to be able to say, let's find better ways of treating a condition, is to first have uniform ways of describing that condition. And as I shared, you know, when I was in training, there were different names for it, and that causes confusion. So
yes,
trying to come to terms with, well, this is what we mean when we say multiple systems atrophy. These are the two sub-varieties of it. This is how we're going to measure disability. So developing the scales to measure disability, the Unified MSA Rating Scale, other scales for quality of life in MSA, developing those, finding you know, better ways of picking up the red flags for early recognition of multiple systems atrophy, finding better ways of picking up red flags on imaging, on brain scans. The most recent advancements that I really am optimistic about that are going to be quite impactful are to do with the misfolding of alpha synuclein. So ways of picking that up, what are called amplification assays. So assays which allow us to be able to pick up misfolded alpha synuclein early. And there's some suggestion that if we seed those assays with the tissue from an individual with MSA versus Parkinson's, the results are a little different. How fast that seed amplification works is different between the two. Looking at skin punch biopsies under the microscope and doing the staining of alpha synuclein in the nerve fibers there, that there are differences between the group that has Parkinson's versus multiple systems atrophy. So all of those are basically the underpinnings. They're the kind of the bottom of the immersed iceberg here. All of that advancement was necessary to bring us to a place where we can start to get people in early in a research project and use common ways of defining what's a measure of change. And we didn't have those starting when I first entered neurology training. We were just trying to build those. They've come a long ways. In addition to this, we have made incremental progress in being able to treat some of the very debilitating symptoms of multiple systems atrophy, including, for example, with treating orthostatic hypotension or neurogenic orthostatic hypotension and MSA with drugs. One of the first trials that was involved in Phoenix was the development of droxidopa or Northera for treating neurogenic orthostatic hypotension. And that's one of the key kind of pillars of available treatment now. We have done a lot of work as a group in trying to find ways to slow the progression of MSA. And like in Parkinson's, so if we think of these as cousins, the bigger cousin, the, you know, one that certainly tends to suck a lot more oxygen from the room, is Parkinson's disease. There's a lot more time, energy, and investment that has gone on to finding ways to slow the progression of that. Similarly, there's been time and trials that have gone into ways to slow the progression of multiple systems atrophy. We've had several failed studies in both. In multiple systems atrophy, we've had trials of riluzole, risagiline, rapamycin, others that mesenchymal stem cells, which look promising, but so far have not shown a clear advantage in slowing MSA progression. And so we've had multiple failed trials. There are now trials of small molecules of medicines that would change the clumping, the misfolding of alpha-synuclein that causes damage to glia, the cells that support nerve cells, as well as nerve cells in the brains of people with multiple systems atrophy. And then trials in of using monoclonal antibodies, so antibodies that are developed in the lab to bind to and help clear misfolded alpha-synuclein from brains of people with MSA. Those are still in the works. There are others that are looking at growth factors, et cetera, that are, again, in the execution stage. So they've been developed. The protocol has been agreed upon by a group of, by the, you know, the sponsor, as well as a group of investigators. And we're recruiting people for those trials now.
Well, we're really getting good information today. Tell me about what advice you would give to patients and caregivers that are seeking the most recent effective treatments for this disorder.
I think the main, and I would, you know, reflect a little bit on this, but I think that the main message is that living with a neurodegenerative disorder is hard, but especially a complex and pleomorphic or a disorder with many faces like multiple systems atrophy. It is especially hard to on your own deal with the amount of information that's out there to try and navigate a path. And so the main suggestion I would have is to find centers that have expertise in managing neurodegenerative disorders, managing multiple systems atrophy, if we can find. Like, we are a MSA center of excellence, but there's only a few in the country that have that designation.
So yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah. So if you can find a center that understands and manages Parkinson's and Parkinson's family of disorders in a multidisciplinary approach, I think it's really important to do that for people living with MSA. Although, there's no study showing that movement disorders experts do better at managing MSA. There are similar studies in Parkinson's, but since MSA is, you know, as I said, there's fewer people living with multiple system atrophy. I think the here expert opinion that people with expertise in movement disorders would do better probably is very reliable as a marker of what would come out of an actual trial of where people do well. You know, you're more likely to do better with a neurologist and a primary trying to manage this. You're more likely to do better with a movement disorders expert than a neurologist managing multiple systems atrophy. So that's number one, is to find a center with expertise in movement. The other advice is if you don't have access to trials, you're working with a movement disorder specialist that, you know, is good in clinical practice but does not have access to trials, a lot of times they would seek to matchmake you, to find you centers that do have trials available. And I think it's really important for people living with MSA, for their care partners, to consider being involved in clinical research. Remember, we're in this together, and I can't find a treatment or a cure without multiple things happening, without engagement from our patients, and without God nodding and saying, yes, this is the right door to knock at, right? So we need people to be involved in clinical research to for us to find success with slowing down the progression of the disease. And also, you know, awareness and education, which is important part of what we do, making sure people are aware of the resources that are available to them, including what's happening on the research front, making sure that they're aware of the resources within the clinic, that what can physical therapy and speech and occupational help you with, how is nutrition critical to you maintaining you know, your fight and your body's health while you are battling multiple systems atrophy. All of those are important while we work on finding a cure or finding a way to stop MSA in the future.
Thank you for that. Yeah, Dad was just going to a Parkinson's group because that's the best he could do around his area.
Right.
Are you a member of the Movement Disorder Society?
Yeah, I've been a member of the Movement Disorder Society since about 2006 or so, since some of the initial clinical research that I got involved in. And it's a wonderful group. They do a lot of important work in educating mainly providers. So there's a small engagement with the patient and care partner groups, but the primary engagement from the MDS tends to be with on the provider side, making sure that providers are aware of what's the latest in both clinical care and research for managing complex disorders like multiple systems atrophy.
Thank you. Now, I want to ask you a question that's not on the list. It's a bit of a curveball. And I would assume, which is bad, that if there was a doctor, a clinic, a facility, anywhere in this world of ours that had success of having the ability to treat, you know, using methods of, say, stem cells, that you would, it would make headlines. Or, you know, being open-minded, I've never seen it on the news, but yet I hear on social media and I read everywhere, everything, that, you know, there's doctors in the middle of Mexico, Chile, Argentina, Colombia, having great success in curing neurodegenerative disorders, including MSA. Have you seen or heard of any type of improvement treatment, even if it's a one-off treatment for multiple system atrophy?
I think that's an important question, and I will actually sidestep it for a story. My boss, where I trained when I took my first job, it was in Phoenix. My boss, Abe Lieberman, is a preeminent neurologist when it comes to treating Parkinson's. Many of the drugs that are available on the market to treat Parkinson's disease, he helped bring through clinical trials. Like many of the drugs that are available now, I've helped bring through trials. And Abe shared that, you know, this over multiple epochs, he shared an anecdote. For a while, there was a neurosurgeon in Mexico that was using adrenal tissue from pigs and then humans in treating Parkinson's disease. Adrenal glands are glands that sit on top of the kidney and make adrenaline, the hormone that's synonymous with the glands themselves. And they have the machinery to essentially make dopamine, but that's not their primary purpose. The job that they do is to make adrenaline. And for a while, a very charismatic neurosurgeon in Mexico was transplanting adrenal tissue from people's adrenal glands into the brain. And for a long time, in the field of Parkinson's disease, there was a lot of buzz about the success of that treatment.
Remember I told you, why don't they just give adrenaline pills?
Right. So and this is in the 80s and early 90s. So, and a lot. So again, remember, when there's messaging about something, it is confusing for our patients, their families, to sort out what is reliable and what is a scam or not reliable. It's difficult because it was really difficult for medical experts like Abe, who treated Parkinson's on a daily basis, to be able to sort out whether the information out of this group in Mexico that were transplanting adrenal tissue and sharing great success in treating Parkinson's was reliable or not. He visited with the surgeon, very charismatic person. He shared the, you know, success of their treatment. And over time, as greater scrutiny took place, if it was felt that the treatments not only did not work, but also that the surgeon was not as good at putting the adrenal gland tissue where he said he was putting. So, and I think, and I can predict, David, that this will come up later in our conversation. But many patients who are living with neurodegenerative disorders want to feel better. The more expensive, invasive, or risky the quote-unquote treatment is, the greater they want it to be successful. And there's, in Parkinson's especially, there's a big placebo effect that temporarily things can improve by a magnitude of 40 or 50% better. We see all the time in clinical trials, literally all the time. And that's the essentially the reason for doing controlled clinical trials, is to be able to separate out what is true effect from what is from a bias from the reporting surgeon or the group, or a keen willingness for our patients to find benefit, in spite of the fact that they understand going into many of our randomized clinical trials that we don't know what the effect is going to be. The reason why a drug is in trials is because we don't have a clear evidence of its effectiveness and safety. So we see placebo effects in that group in people with Parkinson's or multiple system atrophy quite commonly. They tend to dissipate over time. So the length of observation is important. The fact that there has to be a control group is important. The fact that there has to be a biological plausibility to a treatment, all of those are taken into account in when we are trying to evaluate or assess the efficacy of a treatment. And so as medical experts, sometimes we have a hard time. The best advice I could give is, if you are considering being in a clinical research, you know, project anywhere in the country, talk with your provider, with your doctor, that you're considering it. And at least for research work that happens in the United States, the touchstone that something is a reasonable research project is that you would have to contribute zero out of your pocket for being in a trial. Trial-related work is, the cost of that is picked by the sponsoring organization, the sponsor agency. So if it's an NIH-funded trial, or if it's a industry-funded trial, the sponsor takes on that burden of paying for trial-related activities, everything that is trial-related. And so if you're being passed on the cost for being in a trial, that's really, you have to be careful about proceeding with it. And remember, I will talk about ethics of trials, you know, maybe at a separate talk. But when we are dealing with a devastating disorder like multiple systems atrophy, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on our patients who are seeing a decline week by week, month by month, to do something. It is important that you don't do the wrong things. And that's where hopefully you have the relationship with your doctors, and the willingness on the part of everybody in that group to have open discussions about what's available, what you're considering, and whether or not to pursue that.
Now, I'm going to make a few people angry at me, but I am in favor of clinical trials with placebos. I understand why they're there. I understand. Are you in favor of those being placebos when it comes to in terms of neurodegenerative diseases like MSA, knowing that these diseases always end in the, unfortunately, the passing of the patient? Are you still in favor of wanting to have those placebos in place given those factors?
So it's not, this is not opinion. This is science, David, is that for us to be able to understand what the effects of an intervention are, positive and negative. And remember, there are clearly interventions that have negative consequences, including several that I've been a part of. I do clinical research. This is what bringing new drugs to the market for our patients with devastating illnesses is my life's work. And in my work with our patients and various sponsoring agencies about developing newer treatments, there are several where there were negative consequences, negative effects of a treatment. What we need is to be able to measure against a group where the treatment is not being used. So both looking for positive effects, efficacy, and negative effects, side effects or AE profiles. We need a comparator group. What I am not in favor of is for our patients to engage in these trials. And if a treatment is safe and appears to be effective, for a group to be kept devoid of that treatment option. And many trials where we have a reasonable safety record of the IP, the investigational product, would include what's called an open label extension. The open label extensions are basically where you and the treating physician and the sponsoring agency all know that you're on the investigational product at a given dose and with a given frequency. So there is no placebo part in the open label extension. But trials that are used to assess efficacy and safety require by default the presence of a placebo arm, the comparator arm, against which we would compare the change in symptom burden or signs or whatever our endpoint of interest is. And so we can't do trials without a placebo arm. It's not just an opinion, this part. This is basic experimental design that, unfortunately, when you do trials without a comparator arm, the results are going to be questioned for validity because of the lack of comparator arm. So the results are useless. Somebody says, I've treated, 1,000 people with this drug and my patients do tremendously well. Well, congratulations to them, but those are not valid. That's not a valid statement.
Right. The original AAV2 GDNF that the one I'm leading up to in January coming up, the original investigation with the clinical trial did not involve a placebo. They had a success rate of 40, 50, 60% rate of basically getting back to normal or near normal. And by the way, I completely agree with you 100%. You said that, we have to have the placebo. And even if I get the placebo on my surgery on January 17th, I would do it all over again because I understand the importance of it. But nobody on that clinical trial, when it first started, one part of it, did they believe the results? Sometimes we think things that are not true, and our mind plays games, which is why the placebo effect is very important. But I completely agree with you 100% about that. What are some of the endpoints of a clinical trial You know, do they have higher points, lower points? Do they go from running to walk, or running to marathon, from walking to jogging, from nothing to walking? What are those specific criteria endpoints for clinical trials?
So endpoints for clinical trials vary depending on a number of factors. And so I'll give the example of a trial that we have going on here at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. The trial is sponsored by a company called Takeda. The drug doesn't have a name yet. It's TAC-341. That's the closest to the name. What it is a monoclonal antibody against alpha-synuclein. So it binds to clumped up alpha-synuclein that's specific to multiple systems atrophy and allows for it to be cleared such that damage from that can be reduced in brains of people with multiple systems atrophy. And the primary endpoint that they're deploying, what they're using, primary endpoint is what the, as we were developing a clinical trial, what we bet our money on as a marker of change, so that after the fact, we can't say, oh, we put our money on black, when in reality, we put our money on red 17 or whatever, you know. So these are gambling terms. So it allows for you, for your audience, to understand that when we're looking at clinical trials, there's a tremendous amount of data that comes out of them. And because of flukes of statistics, it's possible that even by chance alone, some of the endpoints that we're measuring may show statistical success when in reality that was chance alone. So when we're developing trials, we have to say this is the a priori pre-specified endpoint that is meaningful and that is acceptable to regulatory bodies like the FDA that we are saying our drug is going to make a difference in. And for the TAC-341 trial, it is it's part one of the UMSARS, Unified MSA Rating Scale. The exam part, looking at the total disability, it's a composite endpoint, which means that it's not a single, it's not a marker of a single point of disability. It's not a marker of, well, somebody was able to continue to walk without the use of an assistive device. We're looking at the entire spectrum of disability, from slowness, stiffness, dystonia, changes in walking, etc., changing from before to after. And there's a measure of meaningful change in UMSARS, which will essentially be used as a marker of success for the trial. There are several secondary endpoints, mainly safety related. Was the drug tolerated well? And exploratory endpoints. Exploratory meaning we don't fully understand the utility, but it makes common sense to be able to measure some of these. For example, I mean, we say that UMSARS did not change or change to a lesser extent. Is there a device, a wearable device that could measure how you're moving around that corroborates that there's a lesser change in the degree of MSA disability that you're experiencing, things like that. So there's going to be an exploratory, there are going to be several exploratory endpoints. Others include changes on brain volume, for example. You know, can we look at, you know, overall on MRI scans, look at the rate of shrinkage of the brain, so to speak, and show that there's a difference between those two. Now, the FDA would say the exploratory endpoints, thank you very much. They may be concordant. They may be pointing in the same direction, but we don't know what to do with that. We would much rather rely on hard endpoints like the UMSARS change, or that plus patient reported outcomes. So outcomes that our patients say of how they felt, are they able to maintain their ability to do their day-to-day function better? Is their quality of life improved? Is their ambulatory ability overall more preserved in one group versus the other? So again, lots of endpoints that are tracked. the primary endpoint is a rate of change of disability on a common measure called the UMSARS.
One last question, and I definitely want to thank you ahead of time for being with us. In your opinion, how soon do you believe that we are to finding a therapeutic, or maybe not necessarily a cure, but something that you know that can put a dent in this awful disease?
So I think I may have shared this with Daisy when I've seen her in the clinic, but I have stopped issuing predictions. And that's in part because I'm the kind of the main pillar of our interactions is honesty in our interactions. So, and I worked with, including mentors who are really incredible people, honest people, who because of their optimism would say, we'll have something in time X, say 10 years. And they'd been saying that for 30 years of their practice. I don't want to be one of them. I don't know when we will have a treatment. What my promise to our patients with multiple systems atrophy is that we're going to keep knocking at the door till God says this is the right door. And we are knocking at many doors right now.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to share?
Now, I think y'all are doing a tremendous work. You know, we appreciate that as the providers who are also engaged in this shared fight. We're in this together, as I said. Keep up the work. I know that people with MSA, their family members, the community really appreciates that.
Well, I always say we're all MSI crusaders.
That's true. Yeah. And again, I think, you know, spreading the word is the kind of being the messenger, and also sharing how y'all's experience is as you've worked with people, with providers who take care of MSA. You've gone on to say, I'm going to be the participant in research. Even if it doesn't work out for me, I know it's going to pave the field for somebody in the future. So, you know, keep up that strong work.
Yeah, you have to check out David's YouTube channel. He's got a YouTube channel where he is actually documenting his journey.
Okay. And you're, Daisy, you're documenting it in the form of books. And so, you know, keep that up. I think everybody is doing it through their own media, and we appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. You know, you're a busy man, and we really appreciate you coming on MSA Crusaders today.
Thank you for having me. Okay.